Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. Well, we'll get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one, Autumn Sorellas. Like many young folks who love animals, Autumn set her sights early on a career where she could spend her days interacting with the fascinating creatures of our planet. Vet medicine and agricultural production seemed to be the only career opportunities available at the time, so she started a path towards vet school. However, once she had the chance to work in a vet school prior to applying, she recognized that her passion for progressive animal welfare refinement was beyond what the school was able to satisfy. Autumn then opted to study animal welfare and behavior as a grad student at Purdue University. Following school, she spent 17 years leading a behavior and husbandry program in a medical research facility, where she could apply her understanding of asking animals questions about their environments. After experiencing compassion fatigue, Autumn went on to work with learners with autism spectrum disorder and obtained a certification as an autism specialist. Here, she was able to make sense of her years in animal training with the foundations of behavior analysis. Now, Autumn is directing the animal care program at Elon Musk's neurotech company Neuralink. Her goal is to transform animal medical research into a space that more resembles our human experience in voluntary participation of research studies. So without further ado, it's our great pleasure to welcome Autumn to the ATA podcast show today. She's patiently waiting by. Autumn, thank you so much for taking time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Oh, thank you so much, Ryan. I really enjoy being here today.
And a shout out to Anna Bartosik, who you met briefly at ChatCon.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. She introduced us.
And she enthusiastically introduced us. She told me that I had to, but she highly recommended that I speak to you and share what you have to share with our community via this podcast show. So thank you, Anna. Thank you. And the great creators of ChatCon as well. You've recently speaking at the Convergence of Human and Animal Training and Technology Conference, Autumn. How was that experience?
Oh my gosh, it was so fun. We just had such a great time. The range of speakers and the knowledge that's shared there is just incredible. So it was the first time that I had attended. So it was such an honor. Yeah.
And shout out to Rhino and Absolutely. Joan and Teresa, the tag team.
Yeah. They're amazing.
They are. They do an amazing job of putting that conference together and disseminating information and being creative and inspirational in our industry. So much gratitude to start this show off, but let's dive straight into the first question for you today, Autumn. Could you please take everyone listening back and share with us your story, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share some stories with us from your journey?
Sure. Yeah. Well, prior to really learning about positive reinforcement training, I think I had my first experience with formalized animal training in the form of a dog obedience class. And I do think that that class had some elements of positive reinforcement, but I don't really remember that being the main focus of the class, which kind of makes sense. This is kind of a more of a traditional era back in that time. I was just 12 years old, and I had brought my brand new German Shepherd mixed puppy with me, and we both had lots of energy and lots of excitement. And this was just the sweetest dog. She was very young and hadn't learned many manners yet. So, you know, we were both there to kind of learn and work on that together. And I remember that they had the class working in different stations. So, you know, my dog, whose name was Candy, and I were in the recall station. So we were working on her, you know, being sent out and being called back in. And I just remember how excited she was. She was so bouncy. And of course, when she would come back in, she was so happy. She was jumping up on me. And of course, she was a big dog. Her paws are on my shoulder. You know, I was excited. She was excited. I couldn't believe the animal knew how to come back. And, you know, I'm just kind of realizing now how in that moment, I was really just celebrating her approximations. I didn't really care that she was jumping on me. You know, I was really proud of her for coming back each and every time that she was called. But our instructor was less impressed with our criteria level and had said, oh, you know, this is an easy fix. When I say lift, you're going to lift your knee real high. And I thought, oh, cool. This is some sort of, you know, magical behavior signal to dogs to sit even when they're like running at full speed. How cool. I was a little naive at that age, but so the instructor resets my dog, sends her out, recalls her, and like a champ, she comes bounding back in, and the instructor says, lift, and I lift my knee, and it strikes her chest, and she yelps, and she falls to the side, and I just remember the expression on my dog's face. Like it was yesterday, and I'll never feel like I've portrayed anything more than I did that dog that day. So that was kind of a harsh start to animal training, and maybe it was a little traumatizing. And so I didn't pursue animal training for a little while, but it was a really important experience for me to have just because I think it actually shaped the path I ended up taking into animal behavior and welfare. So I'm grateful for that learning opportunity. And I'm, you know, sad to say Candy never did graduate obedience class, but she, because I never took her back, but she did still become a very much loved and adored member of our family. This is like the reason I didn't identify animal training really as a way to improve the life of an animal until much later when I was a professional working in medical research with Dr. Hal Markowitz. And I was really super excited to hear Emily Strong's podcast. I know she was able to highlight Hal's legacy of kind of laying the foundation for environmental enrichment or behavioral engineering as he would initially describe it. And I don't know, for those who aren't familiar with Hal's work, you can find any of his books and publications just on a simple search of his name. But his most famous book was Behavioral Enrichment in the Zoos. And then while we were working together, he wrote Enriching Animal Lives, which is kind of a recipe book for how to build devices that offer opportunities for behavioral diversity and for animals in captive spaces. And Hal was a professor at San Francisco State in animal behavior, and he just made significant contributions in expanding the way we think about enrichment. And to me, Hal was very much an engineer. You know, nothing was impossible because he could design and build it. And so what we wanted to do is teach animals how to obtain their own food and make choices in their own environments. And he was able to really help us make that happen in the laboratory. So when I was studying animal behavior and welfare in grad school at Purdue, I started following Hal's work. And I was really determined to become one of his students. But he had actually been diagnosed with throat and tongue cancer at the time and was about to undergo some pretty serious oral surgery that would actually remove his tongue and portions of his throat. So he was, you know, understandably kind of worried about taking on more students and how that might affect his recovery. So instead, he had asked me to come out and assist him with a consulting job that he had at one of the local universities working with lab animals. And so I did that, and I got to work with him for the next 10 years on refinements of the animal experience in the laboratory. And I think just an interesting parallel or side note here is, while this is happening, I'm actually observing his experience with the medical research field for his own health through that entire period. Because at that point, Hal no longer had a vocal voice after his surgery. He was using ASL and assistive devices to speak. And for me, he was often scribbling on pieces of paper out of frustration because I couldn't keep up with his ASL. But the challenges that really came with that experience really emphasized to me and to him even more why we would include access to agency and joy as part of our care program for those whose voices we haven't learned how to hear very well yet. And, you know, Hal was definitely very agitated by the lack of autonomy that he had after his surgery, and he expressed this several times to me that having that back would have made him happier. And so despite that kind of serious surgery, Hal never slowed down. And the first project that we jumped into when I started with him was to find ways to reduce the amount of hands-on restraint that existed in the lab and really allow the animals to collect data for us on their own. And, you know, this would hopefully reduce the stress that was associated with handling. And I remember we started with a troop of marmosets, and we built them a hanging scale that we could keep inside of their own enclosure. But we needed them to weigh themselves on cue. So there was clearly this need for training. And it was clear that I was going to have to be the one to learn that. And I certainly wasn't going to try to repeat history with that first training experience. I really wanted to seek out resources for doing it in some other way. And I had been quickly referred to Karen Pryor's Don't Shoot the Dog. I don't even know who referred it to me, but once I had read that, I was hooked, and I went to workshops and classes just so I could really absorb the material on positive reinforcement training. And we actually did end up training those marmosets to weigh themselves. And that quickly turned into another project where we wanted to train squirrel monkeys to voluntarily enter transport boxes so that they didn't need to be handled when they were moving between spaces. We trained pigs to station in transport carts while they got their echocardiograms. We trained cooperative feeding into different primate social groups, and so on and so on. So we were really able to build a pretty progressive program at that university. And after 17 years there, I started to experience, as you said, Ryan, some compassion fatigue. And especially after Hal passed away in 2012, I was really, really starting to feel it more strongly. And I ended up leaving the medical research field to work with humans and behavior instead.
When you say compassion fatigue, for those listening who might not know what that is, what do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, compassion fatigue is the frequent witnessing of someone else's trauma or their grief. And this is really commonly felt by those in the field of service to others. So nurses, doctors, teachers, veterinarians, animal care staff, social workers, these are all really high-risk groups. And it's such a common phenomenon that it's not really spoken about very often. And that's a shame because it really can be devastating to people's lives. It can present itself kind of in small ways, like maybe avoiding naming animals that you don't want to become attached to because it's going to hurt too much when they're gone. But it often will start to build and become more significant, maybe in ways that are less recognizable. For instance, like spending less time with the animals or the people that they're working with, taking less time to really observe behavior and ask the questions we need to ask to help us understand what the animal's experiencing. And I know a lot of colleagues who've described guarding themselves from building those relationships with animals because they felt they couldn't help the animal in the way that they wanted to. And just personally for me, you know, I had definitely built a reputation for advocating for significant refinements that at the time people felt were really outside of the realm of possibilities. And this is maybe why I'm a little, well, better suited for an Elon Musk company where, you know, flying to Mars would be just a typical Tuesday. But I just didn't have the maturity at the time to do this well and to get buy-in in the way that, you know, maybe today it would be a little bit easier to do. But yeah, it's definitely a thing that exists. And, you know, we've tried to build a committee at Neuralink to help us kind of think through ways that we can mitigate some of the symptoms of compassion fatigue. You know, there's a lot of folks who, you know, have great ideas for how they might want to honor animals after they've contributed in medical research. We talk about different ways to just find self-care routines that work for us while we work in these fields. And these are really important. Animal care workers are some of the most selfless people on the planet. So we really have to take time to recognize them and help them attend to those self-care routines.
And I can imagine that moving from the work you were doing at the time to working with autism, was it a shift in some ways to still being in a caring role? Was it that component you talked about with regards to having to convince others about concepts outside of the current thinking or current norms that was a significant element in your personal compassion fatigue? Is that, have I understood that correctly?
I basically just started to tire of having those debates around, you know, advocating for what we could do better in that captive environment. And, you know, it really isn't a thing of, oh, well, they didn't want to listen to doing the right thing for the animal. It, you know, there's a ton of different agendas and, you know, opinions of how things get prioritized. And so, you know, you can imagine if your entire life were dedicated to solving cancer or curing cancer, that's what you're going to be focused on. And that's where you're going to want all of the funding to go to, is to that research. And so, you know, there's often a lot of times when we get frustrated in our fields because the funding isn't there to do what we think is the right thing. And, you know, we are all trying our hardest to advocate and to make those concerns heard so that they are addressed. But, you know, after a while, it can get tiresome and it can start to wear on people. And I didn't really know that this was something I was supposed to actively try to prevent. I didn't really know that that I was starting to just disengage entirely from the discussion that needed to be had. So that's why it was really important to me that we did start a compassion fatigue committee at Neuralink so that this was a thing we could prevent.
Yeah, there's not many companies in the world where your average Tuesday is flying in space.
That's right.
So is compassion fatigue kind of, to take away some of the things that you highlighted there and that I interpreted as you highlighting as important, is advocacy. So someone's trying to advocate for another's. There's limited resources, right. But context is also important because, as you said, you're now in an organization where the mindset's different.
That's right. Yeah, it's completely different. And it has been such an adjustment, you know, where you spend many years kind of like gearing up to go in and be the voice and advocate, and to come into a space where, like I said, I think the culture is just like, well, of course it's possible. Everything is possible. And why wouldn't you just try it? If there are means to do that. It has just been such a reinforcing experience for me. And I think we are going to do great things because of that approach. I think any time that you are going to, one, use animals in order to learn more about humans, however you decide to treat those animals is eventually how you will treat those humans. So it's exciting to me to see us just forging ahead with asking what can we do to change the way this experience is for this animal. I just know that these same questions are going to come up when we do end up going into a human trial. And that's really important for us to always have that patient's well-being at the absolute center of discussion.
And as you mentioned earlier, congratulations on speaking at ChatCon recently, to be able to use that platform to share your work and share some of your message, and jumping on this podcast today as well, and hopefully other opportunities come your way to talk to other audiences. How important is community, do you feel? I know a lot of people are overwhelmed in 2021 with the amount of stuff going on online and get FOMO from checking all of that out, but has that been an important component for you recently?
Community, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think ChatCon was such a beautiful, refreshing reminder that there are people who are excited to do cool things, innovative things, things that are outside of the box, things that people probably told them weren't possible, and to just connect with them and meet people like Anna is just really exciting. And it again, just really allowed me to kind of renew that passion for being part of the animal care world. It's really important. But like you said, I do think it's hard for us to set our boundaries sometimes. We're all working really hard. And, you know, if you have family, that's, you know, making sure that they remain a priority in your own activities. It's a lot. So it's just nice to be able to touch in once in a while and hear that other people are on the same wavelength and thinking about the same things that we are.
Yeah. And this is personal for me. I know after doing 6 years of ATA, we've had members come and go over the years. Just this last month, a member who's been in the industry for so long, I would say, came up against some of the challenges that you've talked about and has decided to step out for ever or for a while. And you said that it was refreshing to come to ChatCon and see that there are people that are excited to do cool things. I mean, doesn't it just sound like it's true though, right? Because people that like this person I just talked about and like your experience, they don't realize that there's other people out there wanting to do cool things. But when you say it, when I heard you say it, I'm like, obviously everyone wants to do cool things, but it's not obvious to some people.
Yeah.
So compassion fatigue must be quite isolating.
It is. I think, you know, and especially in medical research, it's probably particularly potent, I imagine. It's kind of the area I've always been in, so maybe it's a little harder for me to see from other perspectives. But, the whole point is, you know, unfortunately, the animal is there to either experience something that we're hoping that a human will not have to experience and to learn from that. And so people who really love animals and are participating in that are doing whatever they can to make that experience as minimal as possible. And, if you are watching that every single day, that's hard. And so we want our community, as you said, Ryan, to just take care of each other and acknowledge that these things are happening and a part of our lives as caretakers and people in service to animals that are contributing, and just acknowledge them and reinforce them for the great work that they're doing.
So you left, but you came back. So how did you end up coming back? Has has the industry changed? Has the community at large, or with regards to people who are advocating for and working towards improving the lives of animals in this area, changed? Have you changed both? What led to a decision after your experience to want to step back into this space and make a difference?
Yeah, I enjoyed my time working with Hal so much, and, you know, Hal being this renegade who really was pushing boundaries all the time. It just didn't bother him. If you thought differently from him, he was still pushing. And I loved being around that kind of progressive momentum. And I think when a neuroscientist called me and asked me about coming back to research, you know, they acknowledged, hey, I know that you presented a lot of really progressive ideas that you couldn't really fulfill in that space. What if I told you in this space you would have not only the funds to do it, but the support and motivator behind it to boot? And I just immediately kind of flashed back to my time with Hal and was like, yeah, that was cool. That was fun. If this is really true, you know, if the field is really open to letting us try some new things and we're going to be supported in that, then I'm absolutely coming back. And so I did. And I'm really, really glad I did, because Neuralink has definitely been that place of support and excitement for doing things well. And I've just really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for sharing your journey. And I love that you mentioned that you, I was wondering if you were going to say at some point, and then I read Don't Shoot the Dog. It's such a turning, such a turning point for so many people.
We probably hear that a lot. Yeah.
It's so common to hear journeys that have shared similarities to yours. Not obviously yours are so unique in so many ways, but also there are some commonalities that other guests have shared on the show frequently. So I enjoy that, and there's a good reason for that, because that book obviously has the power to form new ideas and inspire next approximations on people's journeys.
Yeah,
I'm absolutely. Glad that you talked about Howard today, and Emily Strong mentioned him recently in our podcast together. Emily Strong and Ali Bender being the authors of Canine Enrichment for the Real World. Howard's been mentioned numerous times by Sabrina Brando, by Mark Kingston Jones, and Val here from Shape of Enrichment. I know his name's, if you go back over the years of the ATA podcast, popping up all over the place.
Right.
And I don't know if we've had anyone who has worked with Hal so closely as you on the show before, so I didn't even know that when we pushed record today. That's really exciting. One thing that we're actually reading Emily and Ali's book, Canine Enrichment for the Real World, in our ATA book club at the moment, and they've got a chapter on agency. And I know you mentioned agency at some point in all of the stuff you just shared with us. And you mentioned that when Hal lost his tongue and parts of his ability to speak for a period of time, I'm not sure how long that was for, that was frustrating to him. And when we talked about agency and our ATA membership, a lot of people hadn't really heard that word before, or it was new to them to think about it in terms of, well, their practice with canines and other animals. What can you help our listeners understand when you say agency, what you're referring to?
Yeah, we're referring to the capacity of individuals to act independently and to make free choices. So it's that autonomy to have options available around them and to make those choices on their own, uninfluenced. So that's kind of where we're at with our program and where we wanted to create a framework to think about how we're going to ask questions of animals. Where do they have those options? Where do they have those choices? And it wasn't really enough to just think about, well, do you have enough choices in your environment? We also wanted to tap into, do you have access to joy in those environments as well? There's Hal's experience, just like I said, kind of solidified that, because he actually never regained his voice after that surgery. And so this was an incredibly frustrating experience for him. Those around him, you know, he's just the biggest family man, and you didn't do anything without the family. And so it was a very personal and difficult challenge to watch the people around him struggling with this. And I know that he would have done anything to have that return to him. In fact, he was working on getting doctors to help him build a prosthetic tongue so that there could be some sort of speech restored. And they just weren't able to make it happen. And I know that that was disappointing for him. So sometimes those personal experiences we can kind of take and use them to look at the situations the animals in our care are in, and kind of use that as the framework to ask questions that are going to help them in their own experiences.
Yeah, well, sorry to hear about that for Hal, but also I can appreciate how challenging that would have been to observe and then to witness with someone that you care so much about and that is so close to you. So, yeah, that's unpleasant. And sorry that you had to go through that, and Hal had to go through that, and his family had to go through that. So now you're working with Neuralink. Can you explain to everyone listening what Neuralink is, what your role there is? What does a normal day for you look like working at this facility?
Sure. I'll start with what Neuralink is. It's a team of people who are designing and building a fully wireless, fully implanted brain-to-computer interface. And this is referred to at times as a brain-machine interface, or a BMI. And what a BMI is able to do is translate the information from our neurons into commands that are capable of controlling external software or hardware. And this is often used as assisted living devices for individuals with motor or sensory impairments. So for Neuralink, the first target population to support are those with spinal cord injury, which are experiencing para or tetraplegia. So someone with para or tetraplegia, there's certainly a lot more efforts being poured into artificial intelligence at this time compared to where it used to be. However, the state of the art device is still a cranial surgery for the patient, where a percutaneous port or a through the skin port is placed in the head of the patient. And the actual device itself, which is known as a Utah array, is plugged into that port. And then that is connected to external computers. And this is what allows a person to move a cursor on a screen just by thinking about it. And I should definitely have started with the disclaimer that I am in no way, shape, or form a neuroscientist. I spend a lot of time around them, but the folks I work with are really brilliant. I'm sure they would be appalled at my clumsy description of this, but that's basically the gist of it. And what Neuralink is hoping to do is to eliminate that percutaneous port that, you know, it does require a lot of care and maintenance. So their design is to have all of that hardware fully implanted below the skin. So that means there's a lot of miniaturization that has to happen. And what that does is affords the patient the opportunity to use the device within their own home at any point of the day, which is quite different than the previous devices, where you kind of have to be driven to a clinic, you have to be plugged in. You know, you'll use the computer for however long they're able to let you have that space. and then they're unplugged and they have to leave. And so that's kind of the goal and the work that Neuralink is doing right now. And, you know, it's really exciting because one of the things I think that they do that's really cool is they work really closely with a consumer advisory board. It's made up with just like really cool people who have some degree of para or tetraplegia, and just that opportunity to be advised by people who could be helped by the device is extremely reinforcing.
And so where does your role come into the whole process and what is your role and what does it look like?
Yeah, so I'm an animal care director for our animal care program. And what that is we are ensuring that the care that is provided to the animals that are going to be used in the testing for that research to ensure that those first patients who receive this device are receiving something that we absolutely know is safe and cannot hurt them. Neuralink's goal is to get to humans as quickly as possible to help those patients who are, we get calls every single day, we get emails every single day, patients who really want this technology that it would really improve their well-being and their life. And so with that, my goal is to help participate in that, but doing it humanely. So every day my team is in there asking questions about the animal's experience and looking at ways that we might be able to refine it.
And so your job is to manage the people managing the questions, or you're in there doing station training, target training, medical training? What kind of or hands off?
It's all of it. So as a startup, you wear like 10 hats to get going. And ideally those hats start to get dispersed a little bit better. But I've been involved in the entire process. So from just the build up and start of the husbandry program and designing the spaces and feeding the animals and cleaning the spaces and training the animals and writing those training SOPs the whole gamut. And, you know, now we are at a point where we are a pretty much larger team than we were. And I can kind of direct those activities with others who have similar mindset. And it's really cool because what we've done is, traditionally the type of person that would be hired into an animal care program might not have that much experience in animal training. And we chose to seek those people out. And the result is just a massive increase in animal welfare at an astounding speed. We're able to see results very, very quickly because people have the background. People have, they're bringing ideas from whatever world they come from. And we've got bird trainers. We've got marine mammal trainers. So we just hired someone who was an otter trainer, and when you can kind of bring in this other world experience into this space, that the ideas are endless and it's really exciting. And everybody's feeding off of that excitement and recognizing that they are really, really changing the way that these animals are experiencing life. And it's, like I said, it's just very reinforcing.
So before we move on, let's just share with everyone where they can go online to find out more about Neuralink and maybe they want a job. Where would they go to find that information? Where's the best place online to find you guys?
Yeah, it's just neuralink.com, and there is a careers section up in the top corner. So there's all kinds of engineers and I think right now implant engineers and robot engineers are kind of the top ones. Software engineers are ones that we are highly, highly recruiting for. So if you're a software engineer, definitely come by. In terms of animal care, we are continuing to expand. We currently don't have anything open, but as quickly as we're expanding, I expect that to change soon. We will have that listed on the website as well.
Well, awesome. Hey, thanks for sharing everything so far, Autumn. We love hearing what we call people's behavioral odysseys. So we're grateful to you for sharing some of yours with us. Moving forward, I'd really like to talk more about medical research, your passion, your current passion in this field. But I know when I was first suggested this topic, I immediately thought we haven't done a podcast episode on medical research first. We haven't done a podcast episode on medical research thus far over the last 6 years. And I know that I am lacking in knowledge or experience in this field, and my brain's neurons fire to whatever resources they have to inform me of what medical research is, and I quickly acknowledge my own naivety in terms of what you guys are doing and what medical research is. Can you share with our audience who might be similar to me and have preconceived ideas about what medical research is? Just a little bit of a history maybe of it, and then kind of where it's at in 2021 and what medical research, what comes to Autumn's mind when the words medical research are said?
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with that last question and try to backtrack through a little bit of history. But if you have a friend or family member with a disability, you're probably less of a stranger to medical research. It is a field of work where many people are relying on the work to help develop treatments and cures for the challenges that they're experiencing. In my family, in my personal life, my sister was actually born with a traumatic brain injury that was later diagnosed with what's called PDD NOS, but that's pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. And this is now included as an autism spectrum disorder. I think what an animal lover like myself, and I know much of our population and our community does, is the question about if we have the right to use animals in the place of people like you and me and Hal, my sister, to seek those answers. And, we don't. But for me, it might have been a little less difficult to put my judgment of the system to the side long enough to just kind of investigate how I might contribute to changing an animal's experience, because I do have family members that are heavily impacted by disabilities or illness. And I do know that I just wasn't able to ignore the thought that animals are in captive environments, whether it's a zoo or shelter or, you know, food producing facility or a lab. Those animals, they still need people actively advocating for them on a daily basis. And, you know, for some of my friends that's on the outside, and, you know, they do a lot of great political work to help with animal welfare. But we all have our calling to do something for the animals we work with. And this one was mine. I wanted to be on the inside with the animal. Whatever your way to contribute back to animals that are contributing to us in such a significant way is, in my mind, perfect. And again, like I said, I feel really strongly that how we will treat these animals is the way we're going to eventually treat humans in our lives. So my vision for the laboratory animal is ultimately to get to a point where they could fully opt into research studies just as humans do, where animals understand that reinforcement is available at data collection rigs. You could imagine maybe even set out in the wild and see, this is kind of where those out of the box ideas come. But, you know, you can imagine just a whole different kind of system where we don't have animals inside of facilities and people kind of don't understand what's going on, but we're a transparent kind of system. And there's actually behavioral data collection rigs out in more natural environments And animals are free to come and go and offer data at their own volition. That's kind of like the big dream or the vision. And, you know, of course, there's a million different things to do to get to that place. But I'm just really grateful to be in a space where that wild notion is not laughed at. It's considered, oh, you know, that's probably achievable. We just have to keep trying. And I think that's why it's important to me that people stay openly curious about areas like medical research, because their skill sets might significantly improve both human and animal lives if they gave it a chance.
So as mentioned, you're working in this organization that has this culture where ideas are embraced, and the ideas that might be in another context or another organization dismissed are potentially embraced instead. But I notice even when you say here on this podcast, maybe doing it out in the wild, you say it with a little bit of, I sense a little bit of nervous apprehension. There was a laugh. Like, how does it feel to kind of come on the space where I just said to you, we haven't done any content on medical research, you know, and so you are stepping into Animal Training Academy, and it is a progressive organization, but you are speaking to an audience who might have particular condition, emotional responses to medical research. We've all got our,
yeah.
Like, how does it feel to express those ideas to our community? Now, I know this is really important to you. You're trying to, and correct me if I'm wrong, connect to our audience and say, hey, we need you.
Correct. Yeah. You know, probably because of those years working in a space where things maybe were not as accepted or change was a little more frowned upon, and any like real push and advocacy in the direction of the animal, you know, kind of got a little raised eyebrow for, you know, is this an animal rights person? You know, I've experienced both ends of the spectrum. So there's that side. And then, of course, like you've mentioned, Ryan, you know, I am aware that people view this as potentially a very harsh and cruel space to be in. But like I said, I just couldn't get the thought of the animals are still going to be in there. And so if it's going to be anybody, it should be someone who's going to keep advocating and someone who's going to try to push the system in the right direction. You know, and because positive reinforcement training can so drastically change the way an animal experiences its life, we should be utilizing the talents of animal trainers in those roles of the animal care technician. That's the most immediate way that I can think of that will create comfort and joy, you know, give animals access to joy most immediately. And of course, I want this for all animals everywhere, but especially where we're asking animals to contribute to our own well-being in such a profound way. You know, and I still feel like I have to give that caveat of, you know, researchers are not evil people. Like I never met somebody who was in there and really excited to experiment on an animal. I only met people who were really passionate about their work and felt that their priorities, were ahead of mine or whoever else's. And I think a lot of us feel that way, right? So there can't be a lot of judgment of each other when we're all trying to reach a goal that is positive in some way for someone or something. But I do feel like researchers may not yet realize what is possible training-wise because the field of work has, one, been a bit afraid to be transparent and inviting due to that judgment that comes from a lot of animal lovers. That's something I'm hoping people will try to take a look at and again, go back to that space of being openly curious and just, you know, allow themselves to ask some questions without judgment and, you know, not need an answer maybe right away, maybe not and expect to understand the answer right away, But there's also this interesting thing in the field of research. So kind of going back to that question of what is the history of it, but the system has worked for the last 50 years in the same kind of way. So there's been very little adjustments in terms of like how we collect data from animals, because it worked 50 years ago. It was validated. Researchers repeated it throughout the decades. And I think that is really important for those of us who are passionate about welfare change to come in and just kind of help move that and evolve that into a direction that is going to improve the well-being of animals.
Yeah, and I can see that compassion is needed. This is what I'm taking away. Compassion is needed for those who do research, and from their perspective as well. They've got a whole continuum of people advocating for the animals who are trying to communicate with them. There's a bell curve of opinions. Some of them are probably pretty extreme, so they're probably getting a little bit defensive as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. I was going to say
they is a very general term. Like, everyone's an individual, obviously. But I imagine for some individuals, there would have been learning histories with people who they might label as advocating for animals in ways that wouldn't really be congruent with the way that you're advocating it, and then trying to have those conversations with
and. I've experienced that like with a researcher who I just adore, who I think is one of the smartest people I've ever met. And they have, you know, I just recognized in them that they really did feel that the way that they had collected data for the extent of their career is what led to some real breakthroughs for humans. And I could see that any suggestion otherwise would be very painful for them. So, like you said, there's just a need for our groups of folks inside of medical research, and maybe, I don't know, I don't think it's just animal trainers, but maybe more of the public or those who are feeling nervous about medical research. If they could come together and be curious about each other and think about how to reach goals more efficiently, more humanely with each other's expertise, really respecting each other's expertise, I really see this as the only way forward.
And you mentioned a couple of times something that you mentioned to me when we caught up a few weeks ago, this concept you call staying openly curious. So for this audience of this podcast episode, who this might be the first time, like me, that they've really had a conversation with someone who is advocating for, in the same way that we might be to pet guardians of all for our own animals, but in a different context for you in medical research, what does staying openly curious mean when you say that to our audience? What are you trying to what would you like us to take away from that? And what is our next step as an industry to have more conversations and to explore more possibilities with the skill sets that we have? How can we contribute?
Well, I will first credit Hannah Brennigan for the use of that term. That's at least the first time I had heard it, is on her podcast. So, and I know that she gave a much more eloquent and specific definition than I will give. But I think the idea is, you know, it just really adequately frames how we have to let go of our judgments of each other. Or the ideas in order to do the work our planet needs us to do and keeping it healthy and thriving, we've got to let go of some of that of friction. And I think the nice thing that being openly curious allows us to do is to set that down. And it allows us to not need an answer to a question and not need to understand the answer when it comes. And I think a lot of times when you are able to get to that place and just hear each other, there's an opportunity for such expansive learning and progression that it really can release some of those emotions that arise and allows it to kind of move on so that you can get to the next step. And so your question is a great one, Ryan. What is the next step for us? And I don't know that I know what it is, other than I would really encourage professional animal trainers to find out more about those jobs that are available in laboratories. And finding out, you know, there's a lot of facilities that have environmental enrichment coordinators or behavior leads. Those are fantastic positions for professionals in this community to seek out and see if they could, participate in some way, or just, like I said, even just learning about the position. One of the things that my team is doing is getting as much information as we possibly can out into the neuroscience community, out into the lab animal world, so that we can kind of open those doors for animal trainers to walk into.
And have you found peers in your industry who are in similar roles to you and with similar access to resources and doing similar things? Or are these conversations you're having to try and form more of these, because they're not currently... I mean, I imagine the pool of resources available to you is significant compared to a lot of organizations based on Ryan's preconceived ideas about what resources Neuralink has, because I have no data about that at all, anyone.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think it's totally fair to say that we have access to more resources than the typical, let's say, university that's doing research, but maybe not so much that different from a pharmaceutical company. And so, you know, the hope there is that you go at it Hal Markowitz style, just small devices at a time to help people see that just these small changes in the system create bigger outcomes for the animal that people start to get real interested in and curious about, and can lead to more significant changes. One of the things that we talk about kind of frequently is, for 50 years, the neuroscience research world has really relied on just kind of some older techniques for motivating animals to perform behavioral tasks. And that's most frequently the use of water or food restriction. And I think that's where my team has spent a ton of time really refining this area. We've brought in our framework to really kind of look at those questions about what an animal needs metabolically and whether or not that allows enough choice or access to joy. And so for us, we couldn't honestly answer that it was allowing for choice or joy. So we chose to at least experiment with a more diverse diet opportunity that the animal could work for. You know, we're lucky in the sense that we're working with primates who are contra freeloaders. And so they are excited about working in some capacity for their standard diet even. And so when we make that diet very rich and nutritious and interesting and exciting, and it's presented in different ways, and there's novelty coming into it, we see a major change in motivation to participate. And so we have not ever had to use any restriction. And this has kind of blown the minds of a lot of the neuroscientists around us. And in fact, the first 2 years that we were doing it, we were told that this is not a thing. This is impossible. You're not going to be able to get the number of trials. But we've been able to prove that we can. And this is what I'm talking about. This is where animal trainers can come in and think about things and ask questions and help develop some of those protocols to make life just easier. And honestly, not doing food or water restriction is a lot easier. So it's also making the researcher's life easier. That's kind of where we are with that.
Well, we'll call this episode Progressive Momentum and Coming at It How Markowitz Style.
Yeah.
You sent me on a bit of a headspin with what you said there, because you said that staying openly curious means it allows us to not need to have an answer to a question and not need to understand the answer when it comes. And I was like, well, what goes into that space? Because human beings, I'm thinking of like cliffhanger episodes on TV programs where like you need to watch the next episode because you have to answer that question. And then I was like, but maybe I don't need to answer that question.
Yeah, I like that.
I was like, well, I can't ask that question. And, hey, and you talk about contra freeloading, which is super exciting. And what we're going to do, everyone listening, is actually invite Autumn back for a second episode to share some stories about her work for Neuralink and some of the individual animals that she's worked with. So hopefully we might hear a little bit more about contra freeloading then, and a large range of other really cool, practical things that you're doing at Neuralink. For this episode though, Autumn, thanks again so much for sharing everything. Just before we do officially wrap up, we've mentioned this before, can you just remind everyone listening though where they can go to find out more about what you do, get in touch about Neuralink, where's the best places to go online to find out more?
Absolutely. They can go to neuralink.com. They can also reach out to me directly at autumn@neuralink.com. That's my email there. So they are welcome to reach out to me if they are interested in just learning more about what we're doing or how they might break into the field in some way. There's no promises it would happen at Neuralink, but, you know, I'm always excited to help peers find their way into a new career, which I think is a really exciting one with lots of opportunity for reinforcement.
Awesome. Well, we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes today. Autumn, this has been so much fun. I'm looking forward to talking to you in 2 weeks if you're a podcast listener, but really me and Autumn are going to record episode number 2 immediately after this one. So I look forward to connecting with you again in 15 minutes. But from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on so far and make episode 1. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Appreciate it.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.